Dawson, he's here. He has to be in us. So please tell a little bit about your experience in random organizations. And, yes, please.
Okay, if you want, I can tell you about my early formation. When I was an undergraduate, I was in physics, not mathematics. I went, in fact, after finishing undergraduate work, I was undecided what to do for graduate work. I told one of my physics professors I was thinking of going into mathematics. He was horrified. He said, why would somebody who likes physics go into mathematics? I said, well, there's some very good work been done by mathematicians, even physicists should appreciate. And he said, well, for example, I said, well, what, for example, von Neumann. He says, oh, no, von Neumann was just problem solver. But in any case, in spite of that, I finally decided to go into mathematics instead of physics. At that time, I was at McGill University, and Hans Zassenhaus was maybe the only really excellent mathematician who was there. He gave a course in algebra, which was almost impossible to understand, but he got many students rather interested. Then after finishing my master's degree, which was actually on information theory in linguistics, I went to MIT. And at that time, I was also undecided as to what to study. I was, in fact, when I went there, I had some intention to do computer science. And I, signed up to work with Marvin Minsky, who maybe you know. He's well-known in artificial intelligence. And, in fact, during the first year at MIT, I took all basic courses, probability, functional analysis, and so on, and also Minsky's course in artificial intelligence, which there seemed to be so many interesting problems there, I was somewhat tempted. I took my comprehensive exam, and then we had a long walk after comprehensive exam with Minsky, telling me, or what, discussing what perhaps would be thesis problems in computer science. And at that time, there was a very well-known, very remarkable guy whose name was Jim Slagle, who was blind, who had been Minsky's previous PhD student. And he had written in those days, that was 1961-62, he had written a computer program to solve first-year calculus problems by symbolic calculation. And this was, of course, very, very early for this type of thing. But that type of thesis at that time took several years because the computer was very slow. It took 1 or 2 days. You would put cards into the computer. 1 or 2 days later, you would get cards back from the computer. One small mistake and 2 more days before you could try again. And in any case, Slagle had written a program to solve calculus problems by, you know, integration by parts, all the various tricks. And Minsky said to me, well, all he wanted me to do was do something similar for ordinary differential equations. So I did a very fast calculation how many years I thought such a project would take, and I decided the next day that I was going to do something other than artificial intelligence. So, in fact, I was in on the course of Henry McKean on... I guess it was on Markov processes and diffusion processes, where the course contained an early version of the Ito McKean book. And I was telling you the other day that there were several other students in that course, Bert Freistad and Cindy Greenwood, among others, who went on later to become probabilists. So I think none of us during the course, we all talked to each other and we always said we didn't understand anything at all. But interestingly enough, almost all the people in the class decided to go into probability at the end of it, so obviously had a very striking influence. And at that time, we were very fortunate, of course. MIT was a very stimulating place to be, because there was what I really liked, which I never found, by the way, other places afterwards, was a lot of interdisciplinary collaboration and interaction. And in fact, I earned my money by working at Research Lab of Electronics, mm-hmm. where many people were working, but in any case, Norbert Wiener and McCarthy, John McCarthy, another leader in artificial intelligence, Minsky, Letvin, there were Chomsky, there were all kinds of different people from different disciplines interacting. It was really quite stimulating. And but from the point of view of mathematics, the main influences were, of course, McKean. And I mentioned also to you, I was very lucky to take a basic course from Furstenberg, where he gave a very sound foundation in probability theory. That's where I really learned probability theory. And another rather stimulating course from Daniel Ray. Also functional analysis from Irving Siegel and James Glynn. In fact, also, that was an interesting story for you. Also, after I decided artificial intelligence was not for me, I went to discuss with Lim the possibility of working with him. And at that time, I guess his area was really still C-star algebras. So I went to him and I said, well, that was another course which I had found very stimulating. And I found it was a very aesthetic subject. I was exploring the possibility of what to do for a thesis, and I was asking him what would he think about supervising me as a student. So I found his answer very, very striking, and I remember it to this day. He said, well, he had decided that subject was dead, and he was just himself beginning to learn something. I said, well, what are you learning? He said, I'm learning physics. And that was maybe 1962, and of course, I don't know exactly how many years later, but he became one of the major contributors to quantum field theory and statistical physics. So even though he was very discouraging for me to work in that particular field, nevertheless, he had obviously embarked on his change of direction into mathematical physics. And so after these two false starts, I ended up working with McKean, who immediately drew out of his drawer a list of 29 or 30 problems. And he sort of said, choose whichever one you want. So I chose one, and turned out to be a very simple problem. I could solve 2-3 days. So he threw that one away, and then the next one I chose was to extend the work for Frank Knight. Frank Knight had written a thesis at Princeton University on constructing the diffusions in one dimensions from hitting times and hitting probabilities. So he proposed as a possible thesis topic to carry out the same construction in higher dimensions. And that, as you know, turned out to be the area of my thesis work, which was later published in the Illinois Journal.
You had some contacts with Norbert Wiener?
Yes. In fact, I didn't take a course from him, but I had several contacts with him. It was a very striking individual. In fact, when I arrived first week at MIT as graduate student, there was the usual graduate student picnic. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting because he would always look for all the new Chinese students, mm-hmm. and immediately come up and start speaking Chinese. So that I don't think the Chinese students could understand what he was saying, but it was really quite an interesting sight to see him talking to them in Chinese. But he was a very interesting man in many ways, but unfortunately most of these stories that I'm aware of are humorous stories, but some of them are even true. But he would very often come early in the morning and knock on your door and ask you what you're working on. And he would listen and very often make some rather interesting comments. But he was also very absent-minded. And there are a couple of stories that are maybe you've already heard these stories, but in any case, I'll mention one or two that I've heard, or I even may have experienced some of them. One of the favorite stories of mine was the story about that Wiener met a colleague halfway across the quadrangle at MIT, and they had some heated discussion about some topic. And as he was leaving, Norbert Wiener turned to his colleague and said, "Could you please tell me which direction I was walking from when you met me?" And the colleague said, "From that direction." And he said, "Oh, that's very good. Now I know I've had my lunch." another story that just indicates, I think, this I actually observed, even though it's a little bit hard to believe. He was teaching a course in Fourier series or Fourier integrals. And I think one day, I don't know exactly the reason, but for some reason or other, there were no cancels. Classes were canceled that day. And he went to the classroom in any case, and even though there was nobody in the room, he started to give his lecture, which I think is quite typical of him, because he probably walked in thinking about something else, knew he was supposed to go into this room and start lecturing, and he didn't turn around and notice that there was nobody in the room. So these are a couple of my recollections of Wiener. But unfortunately, we only overlapped for about 1 year.
Mm-hmm. And after you defended your thesis, you went directly to Kyoto?
No, after I defended my thesis, I in fact worked for about 1 year. When I was just finishing my thesis, I received a phone call from Raytheon. And the guy on the phone offered me some absolutely... At those days, I was a graduate student making, I think, $3,000 a year. And they, out of the blue, they phoned me up. They said, would I like to work there? And I would get $12,000 a year. So it was just an astronomical figure for me in those days. So I had no other plans immediately, so I said, okay. And so I started to work in Bedford, Mass., in the space division. And in fact, there was some security clearance required at Raytheon, because some military work was also done there, and I was a foreigner, I had to get security clearance. So I worked there for, I think, 6-8 months, and I had to have a red badge on me that I wore at all times. And theoretically, if I was supposed to go to the bathroom, I was supposed to get some special person to walk with me down the hall to the bathroom. But in any case, I think they ignored that after a little while. So I worked there for about a little less than 1 year, and that was on some problems on radar propagation. But after that, I went to McGill University. And I was at McGill University from 1963 to 1970. But, by the way, one of my early recollections of things that I remember extremely well was the 1966 Congress in Moscow.
You were very young.
I was very young. I just had finished my PhD, and I remember very much the very famous session that you and Chung, Carlisle Chung, organized. I didn't understand all the mathematics that was being discussed, but it was quite memorable. I don't know how much communication there was, because it was difficult. I think it was a very big audience. Maybe you also remember more details.
I don't remember details. I remember only that Ralph Phillips participated in particular, and some other probabilities.
Yes, that was a very... For a young person, that was quite a memorable occasion to see Kolmogorov and to meet you and so many other famous people. Mm-hmm. But that was the most interesting for me international congress that I attended.
The first, probably.
Yeah, it was the first, yes. Yeah, I guess that's the most memorable for most people. So that was essentially, and then, of course, in Canada, there are relatively few people working. Certainly when I went there, back to Canada, there were very few people working in probability. Maybe at most 3 or 4 people. So it was somewhat isolated. So in Canada, we tend to get mixed up a lot with the people in statistics. And since there's a rather strong British tradition British statistical tradition in Canadian universities, the probabilists are usually considered to be a sort of service for statistics and to teach occasional course in probability for statisticians. I don't think it's like that in the United States, but maybe a little more so in Canada.
So you spent some time at McGill?
Yes, about seven years.
7 years.
Yes.
And after that you moved to...
Moved to Ottawa. I was fortunate in that when I moved in 1970, and close friend and colleague, Miklós Csurga, he came to Carleton the following year. So we, although we were some not numerous in probability in Canada, it was fortunate both of us came to the same place, so we were able to develop together a graduate program.
No, would you like to tell something about younger generation of Canadian probabilists?
Yes, well, it seems interesting in recent years, starting with, I guess, Ed Perkins' generation, there have been really quite an impressive number of Canadian probabilists. Well, certainly, as you know, Ed Perkins was an outstanding young probabilist who worked with Frank Knight. And, of course, you had Tom Salisbury.
Yes.
And I've been lucky to have several very good students. The first student, I guess, that you probably may know about, who was not my student, but Miklós' student, was Don McLeish. Who was the pioneer, I think, in the Martingale Central Limit Theorem. So he was one of our early students. I had some early students who have done several things, but not so much in probability. I had a student, A.B. Boyarsky, who's gone on to work in ergodic theory. I had four students at McGill. And since I came to Carleton, I've now had... How many students? I've had seven students who have finished, ISCO, and Gil Ivanov, the joint paper that we wrote on the branching and random walks. Colleen Cutler, who was finished just 1 or 2 years ago. And, this year I have four students who are just about ready to finish. One student will come here to Cornell next year, Bruno Remillard, who is working on random walks in random environments. I have another student, Byron Schmulland, who's working on Dirichlet forms on Hilbert spaces. He has some nice results which are inspired by the work of Fukushima, but for little L2. And I have another student, Jean Vaincourt, who's working on some extensions of the Fleming-Veil process. And I had a student who finished a little earlier this year, Rafael Kasonga from Dar es Salaam, who was working on statistical inference for stochastic differential equations. So that has kept me very, very busy in the last year.
Is Peter March also a Canadian?
Yes, Peter March is also, in fact, yes, he's also a Canadian. Neil Madras.
Yes.
Who graduated also from Cornell, is Canadian.
Where is Neil Madras now?
Neil is at the University of Toronto. Not in the mathematics department. He has some special position. I don't think he's in the mathematics department. I just met him. We had the conference in Montreal last week, and he was also there. And, of course, David Tanney. David Tanney was also... a student of Harry Keston's, who's now at York University in Toronto.
Probably earlier, I don't remember.
Yeah, it was several years ago, perhaps before you came.
And where Peter March worked?
Peter March worked with Stephen Ory in Minnesota. And Peter, he will be coming next year to Carleton. He's on the University Research Fellowship, which is, I wish I had one of those when I was his age. That's a position that's paid by federal government, which is a 5-year research position. And in fact, the system is, the idea was that there were several years where there were no retirements at all, so there are no new positions in Canadian universities, so they created this this 5-year university research fellowship with the idea is that it actually extends for another 5 years. So in the second 5 years, the university has to guarantee tenure. But even in the second 5 years, the university only has to pay half the salary.
Right.
So it's it was a way of creating a position. In fact, Ed Perkins, also first year he came back to Canada, had university research fellowship.
But only for 1 year?
Yeah, he then, well, of course, they have the option if they want to switch into a regular tenure-track position, and Ed decided to do that.
I see.
But I think that was a very good program. So it created a number of positions for young people who otherwise would have been unemployed.
And needed to move to the United States.
Yes, or else move to the United States, yes. In fact, of course, as you know, many have done that, but I think these programs have perhaps given us a chance to keep some of the good people.